Hey there, it's Cory Doctorow, and you're listening to my podcast. I'm going to read to you a little bit more from There's a Great Big Beautiful Tomorrow, Now is the Best Time of Your Life, the novella I've been working on. It's getting pretty close to finish now. It's just crested 32,000 words, and I'm thinking it'll probably go like 35 or 36 before it's done. 40,000 words is a short novel, so I'm getting pretty close to novel territory here, which I didn't really intend to do. I was kind of thinking 20,000 when I started, so color me shocked. On the other hand, this has already found a publisher, so that's good news. It'll be published by the Science Fiction Book Club, and then also online, and then in a trade edition. So there'll be a Creative Commons release of it as well. Hope to see some of you this week. I'm going to University of California at Irvine to give a talk. Those of you in Orange County, I hope you'll turn up. It's open to the public. You'll find details on that on craphound.com. This week I've just kind of realized just how much there is going on in my life right now, and it's starting to make me feel a little bit of anxiety. I'm finishing this up, and a story that I've been writing with Ben Rosenbaum, and I got to write a novella with Charlie Strauss. But I've also committed to writing a short story in the next week. And also, I'm semi-committed, we'll wait and see what happens, to doing a new comic book and working on a spec TV show, because I figure everyone's going to do that while they're living in Los Angeles. And I signed on to co-produce a film about copyright and to co-write two books about copyright. I'm moving to the UK in mid-August, and to top it all off, there's a whole bunch of big personal changes coming up in my life that, you know, I don't much care to share in detail, but they're big ones. So, you know, that's a lot of news, and a lot of stuff, and I'm just wondering how I'm going to face it. So if you send me email and my reply is really short, or if you ask me to do you a favor and I say no, I hope you'll understand. I normally am pretty good about sharing my time, but I just realized this week that there's no time left to share. Maybe in a year or two things will settle down again. Maybe not. Who knows? Didn't I say on this podcast a little while ago that I wasn't ever going to write more than one book at the same time again? Yeah, so much for that. Anyways, with that in mind, here is a little bit more part 5 of There's a Great Big Beautiful Tomorrow. Now is the best time of your life. The sun was high and the day was crisp, the kind of weather that made you forget just how hot it could be in the summer. Drifts of colored leaves rustled around me as the bare trees sighed in the wind. The sun was bright and harsh. I'd been through many of these autumns, but I'd never had a day that felt this autumnal, this crisp and real and vivid. There were plenty of wireheads out and about. Some of them were driving transports filled with staple crops grown in our fields. Some were chatting with traders who blew through town every day. Some were just sitting on a bench and smiling and nodding at the passers-by, which might as well be the cult's national sport. They greeted me one and all. Everyone knew me, and no one asked me nosy questions about my condition. Everyone knew enough to know that I was just the kid who wouldn't grow up, and that I could give them a fine show if they came by and knocked on my door. Normally that felt good. Today, though, it loomed over me, oppressing me. They'd all have heard about Lacey by now. They were seeing me walk down the street, so they knew that Lacey must be alone in the carousel. They'd be thinking together, wondering about her, thinking about going over there to find out when she'd be signing up for her wire. And that was the one thing I didn't want. Lacey had managed to change over the past 20 years, becoming an adult, leaving behind tree-huggerism, having adventures, turning into a woman. I didn't want her frozen in time the way we all were. I didn't want to be frozen in time anymore. Besides, she knew my secret now, that my antenna didn't work the same way everyone else's did. If she became a wirehead, she'd tell them about it. She'd have to. The labs had been in the old university bioscience building, but a trader had sold the researchers a self-assembling lab template a couple years before. The wireheads had held a long congress about putting up a major building, but in the end the researchers were made so clearly miserable by the prospect of not being able to put up a new building that they'd prevailed. The wireheads had caved in just to get them to cheer the hell up. The new building looked like a giant heap of gelatinous frog spawn, huge irregular bubbles in a jumble that spread wide and high. The template had taken in the disciplinary needs of the researchers and analyzed their communications patterns to come up with an optimal geometry for clustering research across disciplines and collaborative groupings. The researchers loved it. You could feel that just by getting close to the building, but no one else could make any sense of it, especially since the bubbles moved themselves around all the time as they sought new, higher levels of optimal configuration. I could usually find my research group without much trouble. I climbed a few short staircases, navigated around some larger labs filled with equipment that Dad would have loved, and eventually arrived at their door. There were three of them today: Randy, the geneticist, Inga, the endocrinologist, and Wen, the oncologist. "You think it's cancer again, huh?" Randy and Inga nodded gravely at Wen. "That's our best guess, Jimmy. It's the cheapest and easiest way to get cells to keep on copying themselves. We thought you'd try you out on some new anti-cancer from India." Inga was in her 30s. I'd played with her when she was my age. Now she seemed to see me as nothing more than a research subject. Wen nodded and spread his hands out on the table. "We infiltrate your marrow with computational agents that do continuous real-time evaluation of your transcription activity, looking for anomalies, comparing the data set to baseline subjects. Once we have a good statistical picture of what's happening, we intervene in the anomalous transcriptions, correcting them. It's a simple approach, just brute force computation, but the new ITT nanoscale petaflop agent that IIT nanoscale petaflop agent that raises the bar on what brute force really means." "And this works?" They all looked at each other. I felt their discomfort distantly in my antenna. "It's had very successful animal trials." "How about human trials?" I already knew the answer, though. "Dr. Chandraskar at IIT has asked us to serve as a test site for his human trials research. He was very impressed with your germplasm. He's been culturing it for months." Randy was getting his geek back, a pure joy I could feel even through my muffled receiver. "You should see the stuff he's done with it. Your father..." "A genius, I know. I didn't usually mind talking about Dad, but that day it felt wrong. I'd pictured him once, briefly, as Lacey and I had been together, and had zigged wrong and ended up bending myself at an awkward angle. It was the thought of what Dad would say if he caught me deracinating." "He didn't keep notes?" "Not where I could get at them. He had a lot of friends around the world. They all worked on it. There's probably lots more like me, somewhere or other. He told me he'd let me in once I was old enough. Probably worried about getting generation gapped," Randy said sagely. "I don't get it," I said. "You know, whatever he'd done to himself, you were decades further down the line. If he'd kept up with what he was doing, if you'd joined him, you'd have been able to do it again, make a kid who was way more advanced than you. You'd end up living forever like a caveman among your genius Superman descendants. So he wanted to keep the information from you." He shrugged. "That's what Chandraskar says, anyways. He's done a lot of research on immortality cabals. He didn't know about your dad's, though. He was very impressed." "So you said." "I hadn't really thought about this before. Dad was Dad. He was all-seeing, all-knowing, all-powerful. He hadn't just fathered me, he'd designed me. Of course, he'd designed me to patch all the bugs in his own genome, but..." "So as I said, we've cultured a lot of your plasma and run this on it. What we get looks like normal aging. Mitochondrial shortening. Maturity." "How big a culture?" I was raised by a gifted bioscientist. I knew which questions to ask. "Several billion cells," Inga said, with a toss of her hair. I could feel their discomfort again, right, worse than before. "Right." I did some mental arithmetic. "So, like, a 10-centimeter square of skin?" The three of them grinned identical, sheepish grins. "It scales," Inga said. "There's a 400-kilo gorilla running it right now. Stable for a year. Rock solid." I shook my head. "I don't think so," I said. "I mean, it's very exciting and all, but I've already been a guinea pig once, when I was born. Let someone else go first this time." They all looked at each other. I felt the dull throb of their anxiety. They looked at me. "We've been looking for someone else to trial this on, but there's no one else with your special..." Wen groped for the word. "There has to be," I said. "Dad didn't invent me on his own. There was a whole team of them. They all wanted to make their contributions. There's probably whole cities full of immortal adolescents out there somewhere. If we could find them, we'd ask them. But no one we know has heard of them. Chandraskar has put the word out everywhere. He swings a big stick. He said to ask you if you knew where your dad's friends lived. Dad had a huge fight with those people when I was born. Some kind of schism. I never saw him communicating with them." "And your mother?" "Dead, I told you, when I was an infant. Don't remember her either." I swallowed and got my temper under control. Someday, someone was going to notice that even when I looked all pissed off, my antenna wasn't broadcasting anything, and I'd be in for it. They'd probably split me open with a stick, and stick five more in me, or tie me naked to a tree and leave me there as a punishment for deceiving them. It's amazing how cruel you can be when there's a whole city full of people who'll soak up your conscience and smooth it out for you. Chand Racecar says, I'm getting a little tired of hearing about him. What is it? Is it ego? You want to impress this big-shot doctor from the civilized East? Prove to him that we're not just a bunch of bumpkins here? We are a bunch of bumpkins here, guys. We live in the woods. That's the point. What do you think they'd say if they knew that you were trying this? I waved my arm in an expansive gesture, taking in the whole town. I knew what it was like to have a dirty little secret around here, and I knew I'd get them with that. Inga's face clouded over. Listen to me, Jimmy. You started this. You came to us and asked us to investigate this. To cure you. It's not our fault that we're answering your question took us to places you never anticipated. We're busy people. There are plenty of other things we could be doing. We all have to do our part. The other two were flinching away from the sear of her emotion. I did what any wirehead would do when confronted with such a blast. I left. There was a small crowd hanging around the carousel as I got back to it. They weren't exactly blocking the way, more like milling about, chatting, being pastoral, but always in the vicinity of my home. Someone came out of my outhouse, Brent. A moment later, I spotted Sebastian. We were hoping for a ride, he said. Brent was asking about it again. Uh-huh. And these other people? My antenna wasn't radiating sarcasm or anger, though my voice was full of both. He believed the evidence of his antenna and continued to treat me as though I was calm and quiet. Other riders, I suppose. Well, I'm not giving any rides today, I said. You can all go home. Is it broken again? No, I said. Oh, he said. Brent and Tina wandered up. Brent looked at me with his head cocked to one side. Hi, Jimmy, he said. We want to go inside and ride around. Not today. Try me again in a week. Tina put her hand on my arm. It was warm and maternal. It made me feel weird. Jimmy, you know you're going to have to bring her around to council if she's going to stay here. It's the way we do things. She's not staying, I said. She stayed long enough. We can't ignore it, you know. It's not fair for you to ask us to pretend we didn't see her. We all have a duty. Your friend can get the operation, or she can go. She's not staying, I said. Neither am I, is what I didn't say. Jimmy, she said, and I didn't want to hear what she had to say. I shook off her arm and climbed the ramp up to my door, sliding it aside, stepping in quickly and sliding it shut behind me. Look, I'm a nest! The entire pack had swarmed Lucy, perching on her arms, head, shoulders, and chest. She was sitting in the front row of the theater, balancing. These are some fun little critters. I can't believe they live this long. I shrugged. Far as I can tell, they're immortal. I shrugged again. Poor little fuckers. She shook off the pack. They raced around under the seats. They were starting to get squirrely. I really should have been taking them out for walks more often. She came and gathered me in her arms. It felt good and weird. What's going on? Let's go, okay, the two of us. You don't mean out for a walk, do you? No. She let go of me and sat on the stage. We were in the future set, which Dad said was about 1989, but not very accurate for all that. The lights on the Christmas tree twinkled. I'd wiki-tagged everything in the room, and the entry on Christmas trees had been deeply disturbing to me. All that family stuff. So, tree hugger. Some of the wireheads did Christmas, but no one ever invited me along, thankfully. I don't think that's a good idea, Jimmy. It's dangerous out there. I can handle danger. I swallowed. I killed people, you know. That last day I saw you, when they came for Detroit. I killed 8 of them. I'm not a kid. No, you're not a kid. But you are, too. I don't know, Jimmy. She sighed and looked away. I'm sorry about last night. I never should have... I'm not a kid. I'm older than you are. Just because I look like this doesn't mean I'm not 32, you know. It doesn't mean I'm not capable of love. I realized what I just said. Jimmy, I didn't mean it like that. But whatever you are, we can't be, you know, a couple. You can see that, right? For God's sake, Jimmy, we're not even the same species. It felt like she'd punched me in the chest. The air went out of my lungs, and I stared at her, pop-eyed, for a long moment. I felt tears prick at my eyes, and I realized how childish they'd make me seem, and I held them back, letting only one choked snuffle escape. I nodded, calmly. Of course. I didn't want to be part of any couple with you. Just a traveling companion. But I can take care of myself. It's fine. She shook her head. I could see that she had tears in her eyes, but it didn't seem childish when she did it. That's not what I meant, Jimmy. Please understand me. I understand. Last night was a mistake. We're not the same species. You don't want to travel with me. It's not hard to understand. It's not like that. Sure, it's much nicer than that. There are a million nice things you can say about me and about this that will show me that it's really not about me. It's just a kind of emergent property of the universe with no one to blame. I understand perfectly. She bit her lip. That's it, huh? She didn't say anything. She shook her head. So, what did I get wrong, then? Without saying another word, she fled. I went outside a minute later. My neighbors radiated curiosity. No one asked me anything about the woman who'd run into the carousel and taken off. Her stuff was still in my little sleeping space and leaned up against the stage. I packed it as neatly as I could and set it by the door. She could come and get it whenever she wanted. The fourth scene of the Carousel of Progress is that late 80s sequence. We had other versions of it in the archives, but the 80s one always appealed to Dad, so that was the one that I kept running most of the time. Like I said, it's Christmas time, and there's a bunch of primitive new technology on display, a terrible video game, an inept automatic cooker, a laughable console. The whole family sits around and jokes and plays. Grandpa and Grandma are vigorous, independent. Sister and brother are handsome young adults. Mom and Dad are a little older, wearing optical prostheses. Dad accidentally misprograms the oven and the turkey is scorched. Everyone laughs, and they send out for pizza. I always found the scene calming. It was supposed to be set a little in the future to inspire the audience to see the great big beautiful tomorrow shining at the end of every day. For a while, the theme of the ride had been, now is the best time of your life, which seemed to be a little more realistic. Who knew what tomorrow would be like? Dad believed in progress, I've come to realize. He made me because he believed that the human race would be supplanted by something transhuman, beyond human, like it would go squirrel, monkey, ape, caveman, human, me. He was the missing link between the last two steps, the human who'd been modded into transhumanism. But if Dad were alive today, he'd probably be learning from his mistakes with me and making a 2.0 version, someone who made me look as primitive as I made Dad look. And 20 years after 2.0, there'd be a 3.0, a whole generation more advanced, maybe 20 feet tall and able to grow extra limbs at will. And in 1,000 years, we'd be alive, still, weird, immortal cavemen surrounded by our telepathic, shape-shifting, hyper-intelligent descendants. Progress. I heard Lacey let herself in on the second night. I'd lain awake all night on the first night, waiting for her to come back for her bedroll and her cowl. When she didn't, I figured she'd found somewhere warm to stay. There had been a lot of treehouse seed in the air for the past 4 or 5 years, and the saplings were coming up now, huge hollow root balls protruding from the ground. They grew very fast, like all good carbon-sinking projects, but they had a tendency to outcompete the local species, so the wireheads chopped them down and mulched them when they took root. Still, you didn't have to go very far into our woods to find one. I spent the next day paying social calls on wireheads, letting their talk about crops and trade while away the hours, just spending the time away from home so I wouldn't have to see Lacey if she came back for her things that day. But when I came home and said hello to the pack and made dinner, her pack was still by the door. At that point, I decided she wouldn't come back for a while. Maybe she'd found a nice traveler to go caravanning with. She let herself in quietly, but the pack was roused, and a second later I was roused too. My bedding still smelled like her. I was going to have to wash it, or maybe burn it. I sat up and padded through the gloom into the fourth scene. She was sitting in a middle row with her pack between her knees, watching the silent silhouettes of the robots in their Christmas living room. I shrugged and turned it on. We watched them burn the turkey. They ordered out for a pizza. They sang, "Oh, there's a great, big, beautiful tomorrow, shining at the end of every day." The carousel rotated, and back rotated another slice and back to the beginning. The show ended. "Safe travels," I said to her. She rocked in her seat as if I'd slapped her. "Jimmy, I have something I need to tell you about that day in Detroit. Something I couldn't tell you before." She took a shuddering breath. "You have to understand, I didn't know what my parents were planning. They didn't like you any more than your dad liked me, so I was a little suspicious when they told me to take the spider goat and go play with you over in the city. But things had been really tense around the house, and we just had another blazing fight. and I figured they wanted to have a discussion without me around, so they told me to do the thing that would be sure to distract me. I didn't realize they wanted me to distract you, too. They told me later that someone else had gone into town to lure your father away, too. The idea was to get both of you away from your defenses, to demolish your capacity to attack, and then to turn the Wumpuses loose on the city until there was nothing left, and then let you go. But your dad got away, figured out what was going on, got into his plane, and... She shut her mouth. I looked at her, letting this sink in, waiting for some words to come. They told me this later, you understand, weeks later, long after you were gone. I had no idea. They had friends in Buffalo who had mechas in the flying platform, friends who were ideologically committed to getting rid of the old cities. They hated your dad. He had lots of enemies. They didn't tell me until afterwards, though. I was just... bait. I remembered how fast she had disappeared when the bomb started falling, and not into the Mecca, which should have been the safest place of all. She'd gone out of the city. You knew, I said. She wiped her eyes. What? You knew. That's why you scarpered so quick. That's why you didn't get into the Mecca. You knew that they were coming for us. You knew that you had to get out of the city. Jimmy, no. Lacey, yes. The calm I felt was frightening. The pack twined around my feet, nervously. You knew, you knew, you knew, you knew. Have you convinced yourself that you didn't know? No, she said, putting her hands in front of her. Jimmy, you don't understand. If I knew, why would I have come back here to confess? Guilt, I said. Regret. Anger with your parents. You were just a kid, right? Even if you knew, they still tricked you. Maybe there was still supposed to be protecting you, not using you to lure me away. Maybe you had a crush on me. Maybe you wanted to screw with my head. Maybe you've just been distracting me while someone comes in to attack the wireheads. She gave a shiver when I said that, a little violent shake like the one I did at the end of a piss. I saw, very clearly in the footlights from the stage, her pupils contracting. Wait, I said, wait. You're here to attack the wireheads? Jesus Christ, Lacey, what the hell is wrong with you? They're the most harmless, helpless bunch of farmers in the world. Christ, they're practically tree huggers, but without the stupid politics. She got up and grabbed her pack. I understand why you'd be paranoid, Jimmy, but this isn't fair. I'm just here to make things right between us. Well, forgive me, I said. What could I possibly have been thinking? After all, you were only just skulking around here, gathering intelligence, slipping off into the night. After all, you only have a history of doing this. After all, it's only the kind of thing you've been doing since you were a little girl. Goodbye, Jimmy, she said. You have a nice life, all right. She went out into the night. My chest went up and down like a bellows. My hands were balled into fists so tight it made my arms shake. The pack didn't like it. Follow her, I whispered to Ike and Mike, the best trackers in the pack. Follow her, a command they knew well enough. I'd use them to spy on my neighbors after arriving here, getting the lay of the land. Follow her, I said again, and they disappeared out the door, silent and swift. I could watch and record their sensorium from my console. I packed a bag, keeping one eye on it as I went. I grabbed the pack's canisters. They were too heavy to carry, but I had a little wagon for them. I piled them in the wagon, watching its suspension sag under the weight. Ike and Mike had her trail. She headed into the woods with the uneasy gait of a weeping woman, but gradually she straightened out. She kept on walking, picking up speed, clipping on an infrared pince-nez that came under the canopy and that came under the when she came under the canopy and into real dark. I noted it and messaged Ike and Mike about their thermal signatures. They fell back and upped the zoom on their imaging, and the picture got a little shaky as they struggled to stabilize the camera at that magnification. She emerged from the woods into a clearing heaped high with rubble. I watched her sit down with her feet under her, facing it. She was saying something. I moved Ike up into mic range. She didn't say much, though, and by the time he was in range, she'd fallen silent. The rubble stirred. Some rocks skittered down the side of the pile. Then a tentacle whipped out of the pile, a still familiar mouth at the end of it. The mouth twisted around and grabbed up one of the larger rocks and began to digest it. More tentacles appeared, 5, then 50, then hundreds. The rubble shifted and revealed the Wumpus beneath it. It was the biggest one I'd ever seen. It had been 20 years since I'd last seen one of the bastards, and maybe my memories were faulty. But this one seemed different, meaner, smarter. Wumpuses were usually bumblers, random walking and following concentration gradients for toxins, looking for cities to eat, mostly blind. This one unfolded itself and moved purposely around the clearing, its wheels spinning and grinding. As it rolled, smaller Wumpuses fell out of its hopper. It was spawning. It seemed to sense Ike and Mike's presence, turning between one and the other. They were deep in the woods, running cold as possible, camouflaged, perfectly still, communicating via narrow, phased array signals. They should be undetectable. Nevertheless, I gave them the order to shut down comms and pull back slowly to me. I stood out on the porch, waiting for them to rejoin me in the dark. Hearing the sounds of the night woods, the wind soughing through the remaining leaves, the small sounds of animals scampering in the leaves, and the distant, frying bacon sound of the wumpus and its litter digesting. There was no chance that Lacey was doing something good with that wumpus. She had lied from the minute she met me in the woods. She had scouted out the Wirehead City. She had gone back and reported to some kind of highly evolved descendant of the wumpuses that ate every city on the continent. I had already been ready to go. I could just follow through on my plan, hit the road and never look back. The Wireheads weren't my people, just the people I'd lived with. If I was a better person, my instinct would be to stay and warn them, maybe to stay and fight. The Wumpus would need fighting. I knew that much. I'm not a good person. I just wanted to go. I didn't go, and not because I'm a good person. I didn't go because I needed to see Inga and find out if she really had a cure for my immortality.